Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, and this is episode 307 of the Colombia Calling podcast. This week's interviewee is Julia Zulva. She has her PhD from the University of Oxford, master's from there as well, and studied at Queen's in Toronto, or near Toronto in Canada back in the day. And she is a political sociologist focusing on women's mobilizations in high-risk contexts, which of course puts her in a special position here in Colombia to talk to us about the reconfiguration of the armed conflict, especially along the border with Venezuela and in different areas such as Putumayo. So we'll be talking to her about the precarious peace that we see in Colombia at this moment. And it's a fantastic conversation with someone who really knows her stuff. So stay tuned for segment three of this podcast. And of course, before I sign out and hand you over to Adrian Alsema of Columbia Reports, reminder to you all that I have a Patreon account. It's under Columbia Calling. And for as little as $2 a month, you can help us improve and grow. So please throw a couple of dollars at our Patreon account. That's www.patreon.com. Look up Columbia Calling. And there will be several different tiers you can sponsor and, of course, become a patron. Become part of the Columbia Calling podcast. Thank you again. And of course, get in touch through email, Twitter, Facebook, and beyond. And now over to Columbia Reports. And thank you.
My name is Adrian Alsema, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for January 14, 2020. The National Army illegally spied on the Supreme Court, congressmen, and journalists, according to Weekly Semana. Information related to a magistrate investigating former President Alvaro Uribe was allegedly sent to the Democratic Center, the political party of Uribe and President Iván Duque. According to Semana, the discovery of the illegal spying practices triggered Duque to fire former National Army Commander Nicasio Martínez in December. The president, however, denies this. The office of the Supreme Court magistrate currently investigating Uribe was additionally bugged, according to Cable Noticias. A Supreme Court official reportedly discovered a microphone in the ceiling above the desk of Magistrate Augusto Reyes a day after the raids on the army compounds reported by Semana. The last time the authorities were caught wiretapping the Supreme Court was in 2008. This scandal led to the incarceration of several aides of Uribe and top intelligence executives. Colombia's Inspector General's office is investigating whether the negligence of two police generals allowed a terrorist attack in Bogota last year. An alleged ELN car bomb killed 22 and injured more than 70 police cadets inside the General Santander Police Academy, taking advantage of major security flaws. The director of the police academy was allegedly warned about 17 flaws, of which 7 were deemed high risk. Taxi app Uber announced it would leave Colombia on February 1 in response to a suspension order. The announcement was made a day after the company announced it would sue Colombia before an international arbitrational commission. The announcement triggered protests by Uber drivers in Bogota, where the app is most popular. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned the Security Council about the government's failures to dismantle paramilitary groups. These failures could constitute non-compliance with the 2016 peace deal with FARC guerrillas. Following the warning, President Iván Duque immediately convoked a meeting of the National Commission on Security Guarantees. This commission is meant to formulate policies to cut ties between death squads, politics, and the private sector. That's the end of Colombia Report's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters close to the stars. This is segment 3 of episode 307. And we have a very special guest on the line. She's here in Bogota, but for obvious reasons, we're not meeting in person. My recent growth to my family, one other little boy has joined us, has meant that my home is now a completely sanitized area and no one can visit. But our very special guest this week, her name is Dr. Julia Zulva, and she is a political sociologist. She did her undergrad at Queen's, and then she studied her PhD at Oxford University in the UK. Her thesis is entitled High-Risk Feminism in Colombia, Women's Mobilization in High-Risk Contexts. And, of course, she's been doing a great deal of work here in Colombia, where she now lives, on women's movements and so on around the country. And you know what? I am well out of my depth with Dr. Julia, but so I wanted her on the show to give us a little bit of an idea, really what she's working on and where Colombia sees itself in terms of this kind of this movement towards a greater, hopefully, gender equality. So welcome on the show, Julia.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It's a real pleasure to have you on. And I always feel slightly, a little bit apprehensive speaking to someone of your stature academically, because obviously I'm a bit of a fish out of water in this. But so tell us, how you decided as a political sociologist, Colombia, this is where I want to work. These are the issues that I want to work on.
I have always sort of worked on women's movements. I did my master's thesis focusing on women in El Salvador. And then kind of as a function of the way that life worked out, I ended up here in Colombia doing an internship with the Center for Reproductive Rights in 2014. And I decided I loved the work and I hated the kind of legal side of it. That wasn't for me. And decided to do a PhD, to pursue the PhD. And originally it was going to be comparative, but I moved back here in 2016. And as you'll know, that was a year that suddenly became very exciting in terms of what was going on here in Colombia. And so although I originally thought that I would leave and go and work with another women's organization in El Salvador again, I ended up staying and working with 3 women's organizations based here in Colombia during this moment where we had the referendum, where the no won, where the peace did go through, and then kind of moving into 2018 when I eventually finished up with my thesis, where we started to see that maybe the peace process was not going sort of as had been heralded. But what became very clear when I first came here to Colombia was that women's movements have such a long history of involvement, of mobilization, of working in their communities, of working at the grassroots level, the departmental level, the national level, and with quite impressive degrees of success. So that really caught my attention, and it was very clear from from the beginning that I wanted to stay here in Colombia and focus my attentions here instead of going anywhere else.
Fantastic. And of course, Colombia is grateful for this because all academic research that is based on our country, our adopted homeland, is going to help in the long run, definitely. And have you encountered then, sort of, let's say, barriers to your work and difficulties in doing investigations of the type that you do?
Not really in terms of, you know, people not wanting me to do the work. I think that, as you say, there's always interest in academic work and academic collaboration with us foreigners and people who are based here and have, you know, are Colombian and have spent their entire lives working on this. Working with the women's organizations themselves was always also it was a lovely experience. People were willing, obviously, over time and kind of as we build trust and as we got to know each other, people were willing to open their homes to me, to talk with me, to go on buses, to look at different parts of the country with me. And I've always been really grateful for that generosity. I suppose some of the barriers, and this has almost been a little bit more recent as my work from my PhD has transitioned to look a little bit more now at the way that women's organizations in the current moment, this kind of, some people are calling it sort of a post-peace moment, others are looking at the breakdown of the peace deal. I would kind of hesitate to call it either of those things, but what I would say is that we know that violence is increasing again here in the country, and that definitely includes against women and women who are working in social organizations, in grassroots movements. And so in terms of these barriers, some of the barriers have just been safety-wise. I've recently been engaging in a project in Putumayo, which is one of the departments at the very bottom of the country at the south, which borders Ecuador and Peru. And given increasing violence, increasing displacements, the increasing presence of armed groups, it's not always been as easy to go wherever I want, whenever I want. And so that's probably been the main barrier that I've encountered recently. Another barrier, of course, sort of a smaller one, is just sometimes, you know, people don't necessarily want to talk with someone about their personal lives, which I understand. As I say, most women have been so incredibly open and generous with talking with me. And then there are others, of course, who would prefer to be a bit more private. And the last thing I ever want to do is re-traumatize anyone or ask them to put themselves in a vulnerable position. But that's sort of a minor detail in the work that I've done. Again, to reiterate one more time, the people I work with have just been so incredibly generous. And that's really why I am able to do the work that I do.
All right. So tell us a little bit about your time in Putumayo. I still am embarrassed to say that 14 years in, I've not been to Putumayo yet. One day I'll get there. But tell us a little bit about, you know, how deep into the Putumayo do you go? Into these tiny towns? Do you go up into La Hormiga, Puerto Asís? Are you discussing, I mean, people recently displaced or displaced, you know, a long period of time ago? Or is it people who've been re-victimized? Tell us a little bit more about what's going on down there.
Sure. So the first time I went to Putumayo was in November 2018. I was actually doing a very different project with the Overseas Development ODI in London and ended up in Mocoa. We were doing some work on the landslide that happened there. And I ended up staying and meeting some members of a women's organization who I'd really wanted to meet for a long time. They're called the Alianza de Mujeres Tejedores de Vida, the Alliance of Women who Weave Life. And they were during Putumayo, if just to kind of give a bit of background, during the armed conflict was really kind of one of the theaters of war that saw some of the bloodiest, most brutal violence, particularly from late 99 and into 2006, when the AUC, the paramilitaries, came into the territory and were fighting with the FARC, who had lived there beforehand, and definitely engaging in just awful violence against the civilian population, accusing them of being sympathizers, etc. And sexual violence and violence against women were very much tools of their social political domination tactics. And so out of this really dark moment grew a women's organization. It's sort of an umbrella organization in that it includes lots of small little groups and collectives from around the department. And they're based in Mocoa, which is the departmental capital. And they're now the biggest and most visible women's organization. They really supported the peace process. They've supported women's economic empowerment. They support women's rights. And when I went down and met them in 2018, what I realized is that they were coming into a different era, in that they'd had, as I mentioned, this kind of early 2000s, very dangerous work where, you know, women, for being part of the organization, were targeted and were murdered, where women in the communities were also becoming victims of this horrible violence. And then the organization had supported peace and had really kind of been this very important symbolic movement in the region. And as things calmed down, as the AUC demobilized and as peace sort of came to the region, they were able to operate and work more openly. But what I saw when I came in 2018 and what people began to tell me, not only in Mocoa, but also down sort of, I followed the highway that follows the oil pipeline from Mocoa down, not into Puerto Asís actually, but down and through La Hormiga, through El Tigre, down to the border with Ecuador, San Miguel. What I heard from the women, again, from kind of the leaders in Mocoa, but also from the women living in the smaller towns, was that things were changing again, that armed groups were coming back, but this time we don't know who's who. We don't, kind of, these aren't people who we recognize. And also that the threats and the violence were returning. And then when I went back more recently, and this was in September of last year, so 2019, I actually just stayed in Mocoa and basically spoke to people based there, because I was advised that going down toward the border again was just not such a great idea in that moment, particularly to go by myself. And some of the women actually who I'd met who were from these smaller towns had had to displace themselves up into the capital because of the violence and because of the threats. The organization has actually, very unfortunately, one of the women from El Placer, which historically has been a very, you know, has a very dark history in this part of the country. One of the women has been disappeared. She hasn't been heard of since 2018. Other women have been stalked. Many women have been threatened. A lot of them now have, or a number of them now have, the protection that's offered by the National Protection Unit. And what they say and what others say, because obviously I you know, speak to other people, not just from the organization, but from local institutions, from local government, is that these women from the Alianza are not only being kind of targeted and becoming the subjects of violence because they're women, in kind of just as a nature, as kind of the spoils of war, as we see that women often are treated during conflict situations, but also that they're being specifically targeted because they became empowered, and that this sort of disrupts this patriarchal order, which serves the interests of armed groups. And so that the women of the Alianza now, it's not just, as I say, that they are organized. It's not just that they're kind of a movement down in this part of the country, but it's also that they're being punished for having become empowered during the conflict and then in the aftermath, and for very openly supporting the peace process.
This is one of those this issue that, you know, the kind of perfect storm of so many different elements that come together, and it's so worrying at this time, isn't it? The empowerment that has taken place, let's say, towards the end of well, that towards the end of a phase of the conflict, which then led into the peace accords, and then I suppose we would say the post accord period, and then further empowerment, and now we're in this, I would say that we're sort of treading water without really knowing where we're drifting with regards to who's, our political situation in Colombia. And as you say, there's all sorts of armed groups coming in and nobody knows who's who. I suppose down in the Putumayo, sort of in inverted commas, you've got your FARC dissidents, and then you've got your, I suppose there's the Clan del Golfo down there. They're talking about, are they talking about Cauca then extending into the south, the Mexican cartels? I really don't know. I mean, it's so hard to know what's going on. And what worries me, you know, when you say about this empowerment and how it's disrupting this, machista, hierarchical, male sort of dominated society. Is this violence at the moment is only going to continue, or am I completely off course on this?
No, I mean, I think that's accurate. Kind of to bring in a story, one of the women who I've worked with quite closely in the Alianza, says that, you know, during kind of the early 2000s, she would, one of her big things was obviously working with women, but also she would work with women whose children had been recruited by the armed groups. And she tells these stories of going and, you know, a woman would come to her and say, "My child was recruited. I don't know where my child is." And she would sort of get on the bus, march up to whoever the commander was, be that the FARC commander or the paramilitary commander or the kind of army general, and say, "Look, these are kids. You have to give this person back. You have to, you know, send the child back to us." And she knew their names, she knew their faces, and although she and her organization were sort of a nuisance, she had that personal kind of connection with all of these people. And she says and has told me that the real problem now is that she doesn't know the faces. She doesn't know who these people are. And so the worry is, you know, be they FARC dissidents or kind of from armed gangs involved in the coca and cocaine trade, or, you know, maybe even foreigners. There's always this talk about the Mexicans. She says that the real worry is that you don't know who you're fighting anymore. You don't know what their intentions necessarily are. And so I kind of was rambling a little bit before about saying, I don't know if it's post-peace or post-accords or what we call it. There's actually an article that came out that talks about the precarious peace. And I think that that's a really kind of good way to frame it. It's precarious in that we don't know what's going to happen. These women, and again, referring back to this, one leader I was speaking to has said, "Julia, it's becoming like it was before." And so I think that means it's becoming like it was before. There's this precarity that we're talking about. And again, because we don't know exactly who the sort of enemy or the perpetrator is, it becomes more difficult to behave it. How do you know what activities does the organization adopt? How can they protect themselves? How can they take care of themselves when they don't sort of know the rules of the game? When you know the rules of the game to a certain extent, obviously there's risk. Obviously there's very high risk, but there are sort of ways to engage in self-protection that that offer a certain level of protection. And I think what's kind of different now is that while the women of the Alianza, for example, are adopting those strategies, so, you know, not wearing the T-shirts or the logos of the Alianza, not traveling at night, having these systems between themselves where they're, you know, sort of phone chains where they're checking in whenever they get to the next town, there's still the uncertainty or the precarity which is characterizing this moment in time.
Definitely. If we can wind back a little bit, and I know that my listeners will appreciate your opinion on this, but the peace accord itself, and I know you have studied it in depth, could we say that it was the most inclusive to date in terms of recognizing gender differences and recognizing, that there is another gender. It's not just a male dominated peace accord, that it was included the benefits for, let's say, women victims of the conflict were included.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is going back to what I was saying before about women here in Colombia having this long history of being incredibly active and incredibly involved. There was real participation of women in the design of these peace accords. I mean, even that wasn't necessarily at the beginning included, and that was something that women had to fight for. But there was this gender subcommittee in Havana that at the same time as the main negotiations were going on, were looking through and trying to really comprehensively include women's experiences of conflict, and therefore what that means in terms of moving forward into a post-conflict Colombia, what that would mean for women and what those kind of gender dynamics look like. As with, much of the peace process, kind of how that's being enacted now is slightly different. And again, I go back to the precarity of this peace. There's a question about the political will, there's a question about the funding, but in terms of comparatively with other countries' moves into these post-conflict eras, it's definitely noted to be the most gender comprehensive.
Yeah, there we go, gender comprehensive. I think that's what it is. But I do really like this term that you've brought up, precarious peace. I think it's the most accurate, isn't it? I don't like post-peace, post. I don't like breakdown either, because I think I was reading something the other day. While our government might be strangling or ignoring their commitments to the peace process, on the ground in these communities, the ones who are, and the ones who've been most strafed by the violence over so long, and who continue to support a peaceful movement, the peace process hasn't broken down. They're still fighting for it. That's why I don't like this breakdown word. I mean, I think we're seeing more grassroots efforts to maintain the peace process. Would you say that there's something along those lines?
Absolutely. I mean, I do want to just say this is not my term. The article is it's in the academic journal Third World Quarterly. It came out in 2018, and it's by a guy called David Mayer and Andrew Thompson. So there's the credit for them. But I agree. I really do think that it's precarious, but again, it's sort of the best we have. And what we have seen is this real kind of grassroots investment, not just from women's organizations, of course, but from campesino organizations, from Afro-Colombian organizations, from indigenous organizations, from all the different sorts of grassroots organizing engagement that we can think about. There is this support of the process because, it's the best we have, and it really is impacting, particularly in the departments, particularly in rural areas. This precarity is really impacting those people. Perhaps there's been a real push towards its defense from the bottom up, perhaps even more than the top down. We can also look, for example, I mean, if we want to look at the actual indicators, the Kroc Institute does a really good job of going through kind of indicator by indicator and seeing what's been achieved and looking at the progress that way. So that is another way of kind of measuring. But I think that, again, when we see in these sort of far-flung territories around the country that violence is returning, that again, as the women of the Alianza have told me, it's going back to how it was before. I think now more than ever, it's sort of important to be, well, as they say, kind of in the name of the organization, weaving this social fabric or bringing together community strength in order to sort of combat some of this precarity.
Definitely. And so, I mean, your work has taken you all around the country. And we're not just in Putumayo. I believe you've been All over. Can you tell us about what's going on in some of the other departments across Colombia?
Sure. So for my thesis, I worked with three organizations of displaced women. One was in Turbaco, which is in the Bolívar department, just outside of Cartagena. One was in the south of Bogotá here, in a kind of municipality an area of the city called Usme, with an organization of Afro-Colombian women who've been displaced from the Pacific coast. And then the third place that I spent time working was in Riohacha, in La Guajira, with another organization of displaced women. I mean, in all of these places, particularly sort of in the Turbaco, Montes de Maria area, also in La Guajira, we see that, again, violence is increasing, that social leaders are being targeted, both women and men. And the other work that I've done a bit more recently, firstly with a postdoctoral project that I worked on with Oxford, was along the Colombian-Venezuelan border. That was a project called CONPEACE, which was looking at this sort of double crisis of the reconfiguration of the armed conflict and then also this mass migration. And I was particularly focusing on women there and what that means in terms of when you have these again, precarious territories, what that means in terms of specifically sexual and gender-based violence. And I've been working there more recently, so that postdoc finished a few months ago, but I've been working actually with a feminist research consultancy called Ladysmith. And what we're doing is less academic and more kind of practical, in that one of the big findings that came out of this, the research I did earlier in the year, particularly in Cúcuta, but again, all up and down the border, I would say that it's the same where I was in Arauca, the same where I was in Catatumbo, the same in La Guajira towards Maicao, is that there's really not much systematic data collection around gender-based violence. This is something that I definitely found. This is something that I know other organizations who've done work, both kind of national Colombian organizations and the big international humanitarian organizations, have also found in their publications, that when it comes to like a database or something of how many women are facing violence, what kinds of violence are they facing? Are these Venezuelan women who are coming in? Are these retornado women, women who are Colombian by birth but spent a good portion of their lives in Colombia? In Venezuela. Just kind of what the dimensions of this looks like. And so what I've been doing over the last months and into now with Ladysmith is we've been working on a project to measure this hard to measure, this hard to capture data, particularly starting in Cúcuta, where actually I'll be heading back there on Thursday. But the idea is to expand around the country. And on one hand, we're using a simple tool that most people who have access to phones use here, which is WhatsApp, to provide information to women who may be arriving for the first time in a new country, and have, you know, questions about the services that they can access, particularly as these relate to violence. Because as we know, women might not want to necessarily go straight to the police or straight to a state institution. They might want to go to a UN organization, or they might want to go to the International Rescue Committee, or actually they might feel safer going to a local trusted community leader. So we're trying to kind of parse all of that out and provide this information via WhatsApp to women in need. But on the back end of that, we're collecting data about sort of the dimensions of this gender-based violence in these border regions, in order hopefully to both from the top down and the bottom up make the information available. And by that, what I mean is, so really small grassroots women's organizations working in these areas in kind of an era of data-driven development need the numbers, need the figures to say to the big funders, guys, we need money and we need funds and resources to be tackling this problem, but also from the top down to also have less of a sort of shoot in the dark approach to how to address this really prevalent gender-based violence in these border regions, and to do programming for both international and domestic funds in terms of how to meet these women's needs.
Wow, it sounds like a huge job. I mean, a huge amount of information that you need to sift through. And when will we be able to see the results of all of this hard work?
Well, hopefully soon. So as I mentioned, I'll be back. I'll be going back on Thursday with my colleagues. And the idea is that we'll get the sort of WhatsApp portion of this launched by the end of the month. And throughout February and beginning of March, we're going to be collecting the data and analyzing it. So the idea is that the database will be obviously anonymized, and so that all of the women are completely protected, but that will be open source and available. So that will be probably available through the Ladysmith website, I would say, is the best place to find it for now. There'll probably be sort of a separate section to the website. I don't know exactly what we're going to call that or kind of how that's going to look yet, but I can let you know.
Definitely. And we'll put it up on our various media outlets. And one thing, as we wind this down, and you've been amazing and incredibly informative, is that very recently, I think it was either this week or last week, Matthew Charles, who writes all sorts of pieces about Colombia and the region for the international press and the British press, has had a piece out in the Daily Telegraph, which was based around, and I know I'm jumping subjects a little bit, but it's gender-based violence in its way, of course. A piece in the Daily Telegraph about the abortions and the treatment of women in the rank and file of the FARC. Have you worked on anything on this level, or have you heard about this? Because I've spoken to ex-FARC members, or now FARC political members, and women, and when I've been to one of the zonas de transición, or whatever they're called now, and of course the treatment was incredibly bad, but it's something that the FARC have tried to, they try and veer away from in any and all conversations. Have you had any exposure to this?
It's funny you bring that up, actually, because later today I'm supposed to have an opinion piece coming out in Open Democracy with my colleague Sané Weber about exactly that, about the recognition of sexual violence within the ranks of the FARC. There was a constitutional court case that came out just in December. It was sort of spearheaded by Women's Link, which is this really amazing legal advocacy organization based I'm not sure if they're based in Spain or here, but they definitely have a big office here. And they had it recognized that women who were within the rank and file of the FARC did suffer sexual violence, particularly in terms of forced contraception and forced abortion. My own dealings with the subject, I wrote a piece with Kieran Stallone a number of years ago about, this was right after the FARC had demobilized. So this was early 2017. And it was, there was kind of this discussion of sort of quote unquote feminism of the FARC. And we went and spoke to a number of people, and whenever we brought up the subject of forced abortion, it was shut down very quickly. Yeah. So I know that it's something that, there's clear documentation that it happened. There's clear documentation that it was widespread. My own dealings with it, and I'm by no means an expert in this, are that no one has ever wanted to speak to me about it. And that's something I understand. But this court decision that came out, and I have to admit, I didn't actually read Matt's piece yet, but I'm sure he mentions it, is really important, because it sort of breaks this victim-perpetrator binary where we can only see women as either, in need of protection, or as these horrible kind of rebels, and says, look, there's a gray zone in the middle. And yes, even though these women were part of the FARC, they definitely did suffer gender-based violence during this time, and that that's actually not okay. So that's it's very important decision, and I think that Women's Link has done an amazing job in terms of championing it the way they have.
Yes, definitely. It's a brutal piece. It's a brutal piece to read. And definitely very important. Well, listen, let me take this moment to say thank you so much for your time. I know how busy you are, and these investigations that you're doing are of tantamount importance here to not only to Colombia, but internationally, so people can understand. Let's say, this whole sort of sphere that has been for so long, kind of just swept under the carpet, to use the term. It really, it's only I would say really recently that now investigations such as yours are being brought more to the fore, more to the conscience of the general public. So thank you so much for your time and talking so openly about what you're doing here in Colombia. And thank you for all of this. It's been really informative. And I wish you all the best, especially with this WhatsApp kind of technology to be able to help, let's say, returning Colombians from Venezuelan women coming across. I think that's, I mean, obviously it's, you know, you think about it, you're like, well, that's an obvious thing to do. But at the beginning, maybe it's not the most obvious thing to do, but it's the most effective thing because everybody has it. And I just think, wow, yes, you know, we're taking known technology and applying it to try and improve and to try and help the, you know, these very, very vulnerable people in these situations. So, you know, as I say, I'm very, very grateful for your time.
Thank you so much for your time. I'm always glad to talk about this. The one thing I'll say before I leave is that while obviously I'm thank you so much for your words, there are also so many amazing Colombian academics who have been working on this and the women's organization. So I encourage listeners to, you know, go on Twitter, go online if they're interested and to have a look for them as well, because obviously they've paved the way for people like me to be able to do the research that I'm doing. But thank you so much for your time, Richard.
You're most welcome. That's Dr. Julia Silva. Nice humility there at the end, but very, very fantastic to talk to her. Check out her website as juliazulva.com. Of course, we'll link it on the Facebook page and on Twitter when this is out. And just keep an eye out because Dr. Julia's pieces are in The Guardian. They've been, you know, published Open Democracy, as she mentioned. They're all over the place, you know, very, very informative and very interesting indeed. So this has been episode 307 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Thank you again to all my listeners out there across the world. I have a Patreon campaign page, everyone. So please, if you can, you can sponsor the Colombia Calling podcast for as little as $2 a month to help us grow and improve. Anyway, so that was my call for help. And I've been Richard McCall this week for Colombia Calling. And this is me signing off. Goodbye and thank you.